Last week, President Trump announced deportation raids in big cities across the country, but then he said he'd wait a few weeks. We check in with immigrant rights groups here in Illinois about how they've been handling all the news. Plus, last year, riders took nearly 40 million trips on electric scooters, and Chicago has launched a pilot program on the city's west side.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, the U.S. women's soccer team is just three wins away from another World Cup. We're going to talk about that, plus how shared bikes and electric scooters fit into our transportation system. But first, this morning, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker signed a bill officially legalizing recreational marijuana. That will happen in Illinois beginning January 1st. Here's Governor Pritzker speaking in Chicago just this past hour.
Today, Illinois is leading the way in demonstrating everything that can be accomplished when we set aside our comfort with the status quo and instead govern with the belief that our best days are ahead. With this legislation, our state once again is a leader, putting forward the most equity-centric cannabis legalization in the nation.
That audio courtesy of the Chicago Tribune, the new law will allow for the licensed growth, sale, and possession of recreational cannabis for adults 21 and over. Illinois will be the 11th state to legalize marijuana. Last week, President Trump said that the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, was going to carry out deportation raids in big cities across the country, focusing on 10 cities, actually, including Chicago. Then, on Saturday, the president said he would delay those raids by 2 weeks. He also said the deportations would start unless Democrats changed U.S. asylum laws. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to people who work with immigrants every day all across Illinois about how the president's decisions have affected them. But first, yesterday afternoon, I spoke with Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. She's a Democrat from Illinois' 9th District, which includes parts of Chicago's north side, north and northwest suburbs. I started by asking her what she's been saying to her constituents about the president's stance on immigration.
There is such incredible fear. That's the main feeling. In my district, where 40% of the people, residents, speak a language other than English at home from all over the world, immigrants. I stood with Lori Lightfoot, our mayor of Chicago, on Saturday, saying that the president just has to back off entirely from this cruel idea. Look, this is politics. This is about politics. He announced this the deportation raids on the day before he announced that he's running again. He thinks this is his ticket somehow to re-election, and in fact, this is a ticket to defeat, because this is, despite the president, a nation of immigrants. And it's been the immigrants have refreshed every generation. My parents, neither one was born in the United States of America. And, the city of Chicago is not going to cooperate with ICE to see these early morning raids commence. And we're going to do everything that we can to protect those immigrants. They have to know their rights. They shouldn't answer the door. If they do, then they have to show anyone from ICE would have to show a court order that they could do this, not just some kind of identification. This is about frightening people. And to that extent, it's probably succeeded already, even without resuming raids.
Representative Schakowsky, apart from the fear, as you're talking about in the politics, we are seeing horrific conditions that reporters are uncovering at, for example, a border control station in Texas. A group of lawyers say they saw infants and kids locked up for nearly a month without proper food or water or sanitation. One attorney, Holly Cooper, told the AP that, quote, in her 22 years of doing visits with children in detention, I had never heard of this level of inhumanity. This is not the first time we are hearing about inhumane treatment at the border or in detention facilities, especially when it comes to children. What is Congress's responsibility and role in
this?
Well,
I have called it concentration camps. Others have as well. Putting anyone, and especially children, in a situation where actually officials of the United States of America said it isn't important for children to have a bed, to have a toothbrush, they've already taken away any kind of activities and legal assistance, sleeping on floors. And when I visited the border, I took one of these so-called blankets. It's really like tinfoil. This is the United States of America, but you wouldn't recognize it when you hear about policies like this. I think there is pushback like you've never seen before. Certainly the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives is not going to tolerate that. We're going to fight back as hard as we can. And frankly, I think most Americans understand cruelty when they see it, unacceptable behavior when they see it. And this is certainly it.
Again, that's Representative Jan Schakowsky. I also asked her about income inequality ahead of a conference she's actually speaking at today. Tune into tomorrow's 21st for that, where we are going to be talking more about income inequality. Since yesterday afternoon, the federal government has moved hundreds of those migrant children out of that Border Patrol station in Texas. 249 children have been moved into the HHS shelter system. An unknown number of others were sent to a tent facility in El Paso. Today, Democratic leaders in the House have planned a vote on $4.5 billion in emergency aid to the southwestern border. As we're talking about this issue, there's lots of things here, not just the children in the detention facilities, but these raids. And much of the conversation around that has focused on the big cities where those raids were supposed to have taken place, of course, of which Chicago was one of them. But communities all across Illinois have felt the impact of the president's comments. So we wanted to check in on places outside of Chicago. Joining me here in our Urbana studios is Ricardo Diaz, a board member of the New American Welcome Center, a founding member of CU Immigration Forum. Hi, Ricardo. Welcome back to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
On the line from Rockford is Sarah Dady, an immigration attorney with the law firm Dady Law Group. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to the 21st as well.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Ricardo, as you just heard Representative Schakowsky describe a climate of fear in her Chicago area district, do you think that's also true for folks in the Champaign-Urbana area?
Definitely. His words, whether they come through the tweet or anything else, they're scary. They're scary not only for immigrants, but for all of us who are standing with them.
Sarah, would you say that's also the same true in Rockford?
I would agree. I think that people, it's important to remember that Trump didn't give ICE a 2-week vacation. ICE is going to be out every day doing its job, which is looking for people in violation of our immigration laws. And the enforcement action wasn't going to be limited to Chicago. It was going to target people who were ordered deported by the Chicago Immigration Court. And the Chicago Immigration Court covers most of Illinois, southern Wisconsin, and northern Indiana. So people living in Champaign, people living in Rockford who have a deportation order, ICE was coming out here to knock on those doors to look for those people.
And Sarah, to be clear,
and that will still happen.
Yeah. So when we say the Chicago Immigration Court, as you're saying, that covers the whole state. So that covers Peoria, Springfield, Bloomington. Lots of people are going through the Chicago Immigration Court, just so everyone understands how that works, Sarah.
Correct. The Chicago Immigration Court's administrative law court that sits under the Department of Justice. It's not part of the judicial branch, but their jurisdiction covers almost the entire state of Illinois, southern Wisconsin, and northern Indiana.
Ricardo, when we're talking about this climate of fear, I wonder if the past week if you feels like if this has felt different or if this is more of a continuation of what it has been like for the last 2.5 years.
You're right in pointing out that one gets jaded with so many things coming out of, especially the White House, but all the people around this on the nativist side. But unfortunately, this time around, even if ICE was saying, no, no, we're not ready for this, the president putting it out drives fear because we fall into it as listeners and as participants in the news cycle. I mean, the president said it. When do you ignore the president and when don't you? So unfortunately, we don't have the luxury of thinking this may not be it. This may be more of the same. It could be more of the same. It is most likely more of the same. But unfortunately, it is the president and he can change things. And so for us, even though it you know, he postponed it again, like he normally does, unfortunately, the fear that comes and the worry for people continues because there are also other administrative actions that are in the pipeline, both in right now in housing and in other departments. There are things being done systematically. I would even say that the first year it was all talk, with a few exceptions. The court held them all back. This year, there's progress from the president's side in that he's got more capable people doing the actual policy changes, which, accompanied with further announcements, just aggravates the situation.
That's Ricardo Diaz. He's on the board of the New American Welcome Center in Champaign-Urbana. We're also speaking with Sarah Deedy, a Rockford-based immigration attorney. Sarah, to Ricardo's point about fear, I wonder how you describe, there's obviously the emotional turmoil of this for certain families and for communities, but I wonder if you can also give us examples of what kind of effect you think this is having in Rockford?
Sure. So it's really hard to live every day with the fear that you're going to be separated from your family, with the fear that the knock's going to come on your door, with the fear that you have no rights and nobody can help you. And that's really how undocumented people in the United States live. And so when the president makes an announcement about there's going to be this big immigration enforcement action, all these ICE agents are going to be coming out, walking the streets, you know, knocking every door, having these dragnets, that heightens the fear. And then the president says, oh, no, 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 I'm going to postpone it. And so you want to feel relieved, but you can't because every day you know you're at risk of being separated from your family. And there's also the frustration that I see every day with my clients, who are lucky enough to have a way to apply for legal status. They have family members who don't. And so you're constantly being told that you shouldn't be here because you're undocumented, you should do things the right way, but you're never given a right way.
And when you say that, right, and so for some people might, so when you say you're never given a right way, what do you mean? Can you explain? Because I think some people think, well, these people haven't followed the laws, they should follow the law. Are you saying that there's no recourse for some people to follow the law?
Correct. There is no law that exists. There was no time, there was no law that allowed the 11 million undocumented or so people who are here to walk into a U.S. consulate and apply for a work visa to come in and work in the United States for, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. There was no process for them, no legal process, and there still isn't. And it's very frustrating for me to see really good people who have lived here, who contribute, who pay taxes, who have family here, be constantly punished and denigrated because our laws never provided a way for them to come the right way.
That's Sarah Deedy.
That's very frustrating.
Yeah. Thank you, Sarah. That's Sarah's an immigration attorney in Rockford, and we've also been speaking with Ricardo Diaz. I also wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Fred Sau is the policy director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, based in Chicago. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Hi, Ricardo. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi, Fred.
Fred, so I know that it's been we're talking about this being kind of definitely a chaotic time for you and for the groups that you work with. Can you first just explain to us, do we know who specifically ICE would be targeting in these situations if these raids were to take place?
Okay. As we understand it, ICE would be targeting individuals and particularly families that have outstanding removal orders. Very often, these are people who were given court dates upon released into the community, but then for whatever reason did not show up, and in their absence they were ordered deported. Very often people, particularly after they've been released from custody, are not informed about their court dates, and so they really haven't been given an opportunity to make their case. But so far as this administration is concerned, they have a deportation order, and now that deportation order is going to be executed.
Okay. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We've been speaking with Fred Sow. Fred Sow is with policy director with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. And Fred, I want to ask you about, I know you've been working with Mayor Lightfoot. I want to ask you about the conversations you're having with other mayors across Illinois. Sarah Dady, an immigration attorney based in Rockford. Ricardo Diaz here in studio with me in Urbana, founding member of the CU Immigration Forum, also on the board of the New American Welcome Center in Champaign, Urbana. Stay tuned. Just after the short break, we'll pick up this conversation. You're listening to The 21st. Thank you for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the past week with immigration news. We've been talking about the president's decision to announce deportation raids and then pull them back, how that's affecting communities across the state. There's also things that have happened here in Illinois that I wanted to talk about with Fred. Sow is with us, a policy director with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. Sarah Dady is on the line from Rockford, where she's an immigration attorney. Ricardo Diaz is here with me in Urbana with the New America Welcome Center. Fred, when we think about what's happening here in Illinois, people may have missed the news that on Friday, Governor Pritzker actually signed a bill that would ban three things that he signed on Friday. One would ban private immigrant detention facilities in Illinois, another banning local police from helping with federal immigration enforcement. In your mind, how does that change how Illinois as a state reacts to these different federal movements?
Okay. Well, first off, Nyla, just to offer a slight correction, the second bill that you referenced restricts local police departments from entering into specific deputization agreements with ICE. This is
thanks for correcting that. 287G.
Yeah. I mean, we would have wanted a broader restriction on police cooperation with ICE, but we couldn't get that far this year.
And so what does the language say specifically, Fred?
So it says that local police departments, county sheriffs, municipal police departments are barred from entering into agreements with ICE under the 287G program to deputize their officers, their deputies as ICE agents. So it's a specific program. For better or worse, this law does not affect other forms of communication or cooperation with immigration authorities.
Okay, so then I know you've also been having conversations with people like Chicago Mayor Lightfoot. She spoke out very strongly last weekend about this. What is Mayor Lightfoot saying? What is Chicago government saying about this?
Right. So Mayor Lightfoot took two steps late last week. One is directing the Chicago Police Department not to cooperate with immigration authorities with respect to immigration-related arrests at all. And then Mayor Lightfoot also cut off ICE's access to Chicago police databases. So basically, much of the information that ICE or federal immigration authorities could use in identifying potential targets for enforcement activity. So this builds upon kind of longstanding Chicago policy that dates back to Mayor Harold Washington that has since been added upon over the years. And so the statement from Mayor Lightfoot is the strongest directive yet in stating municipal policy here in Chicago regarding restrictions with interactions with federal immigration authorities.
And Fred, are you in conversation with other Illinois cities and their mayors about this?
We have not been yet, but we certainly are open to such conversations. We have been working over the last 2.5 years with a variety of municipalities, mainly in the Chicago suburbs, but also throughout other parts of the state, including Rockford and Bloomington and Aurora, to either pass or at least move forward with proposals that would set clearer delineations between municipal authorities on one hand and immigration authorities on the other hand. I should also clarify that, even with these policies in place, municipalities are not able, for better or worse, to completely block immigration authorities from operating within their city or municipal or county limits. What these policies do instead is restrict the operations of the community's own police authorities with respect to immigration enforcement operations and their cooperation or lack of cooperation with ICE.
Ricardo, are you agreeing with what Fred's saying?
Completely. So I want to mention Champaign County in particular. So there's what's written in the law, and then there's what's in policy within each law enforcement agency, and then there's the spirit of how to implement or how to reject federal intrusion in their area. So in Champaign County, for the last, we're going on 8-9 years, from the sheriff's office, they don't cooperate with ICE unless there's a warrant. It's not a judicial warrant. They're not going to take anyone away. City of Urbana passes its sanctuary resolution, but what is more important, the police chiefs in the area say, why should we meddle with immigration status as a matter of course? If it's not relevant to a crime, if it's not relevant to an investigation, why should we? And therefore, we have the great attitude within the departments that then when there is a state law or a federal anything, the local jurisdictions are the ones that are choosing to do what's right and be welcoming to immigrants. And I think that's important not only because the agents, the streets, the police on the streets are different than the leadership and what the law is, and the usually guys on the street, those officers have some leeway as to how they're going to implement. And if the right spirit is there from their boss, from the chief, and from both mayors, Urbana and Champaign, that say, no, we're going to be welcoming, then it doesn't permit this national foul air to come in and contaminate us. Because that's what's really happening. The federal objectives from especially the White House are so negative that they they misdirect our attention from what really ought to be done, which is comprehensive immigration reform.
And I wanted to end by asking all of you that, because I wonder, Fred, Sarah, let me ask you, how much you think that all of these conversations, and Sarah, let me just ask you first, one of our guests who was going to come on the show this morning couldn't make it because she had to drive someone to immigration court. And I was looking this morning at a picture on Twitter of lines wrapped around a building in Dallas for people lining up to go into immigration court there. As we're having all of these conversations, Sarah, I wonder what you think needs to change about the process as it stands right now, because certainly as we're having all of these conversations and headlines, there are still hundreds of thousands, you know, if not millions of people who are trying to go through the legal process as it is.
That's a great question. And from my perspective, I think Americans need to understand our immigration system better the way that it is now. To pick up on what Ricardo was saying, local law enforcement, local elected officials, it's critical that they understand our immigration process. We have had the opposite experience as Ricardo. In Ogle County, just south of Rockford, where Rochelle, Oregon, Byron is, the county sheriff actually drove someone to an ICE field office, took him out of the jail. He was arrested on a suspended license ticket, $200 bond, held him in violation of the Illinois Trust Act, and then when ICE didn't come and pick him up from the jail, had a deputy drive him to the Rock Island ICE field office. And so as long as we have a lot of people in the state of Illinois and the United States who don't understand how dysfunctional our immigration system is, the harder it's going to be to get a Congress willing to pass comprehensive reform.
And Fred, I mean, when we think about that, the whole idea of comprehensive reform, do you think that's been a little bit lost in this conversation?
Well, I think that there's a lot of agreement with respect to, you know, the need for fixes to the immigration system. Unfortunately, given the current makeup of the federal government in Washington, D.C., with the White House, with the Senate, the prospects for more sweeping and more humane policies with respect to immigrants in the United States, as well as immigrants trying to come to the United States and people seeking refuge in the United States, those prospects are really very limited. So this may require some changes in the political makeup of our federal government for the prospects to improve.
That's Fred Sow, a policy director with the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. I want to thank Fred, Sarah Dady joining us from Rockford. She's with the Dady Law Group, an immigration attorney. Ricardo Diaz is a founding member of CU Immigration Forum on the board of the New American Welcome Center in Champaign-Urbana. Thank you all for giving us different perspectives from throughout the state. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nyla.
Hundreds of cities across the country have been experimenting with a new transportation option, electric scooters. If you've traveled to a city like Washington or LA recently, you may have seen them on sidewalks or roads. Oftentimes, you just need a smartphone app to rent them. This is on top of many cities that have dockless bike programs like Champaign and Chicago. Rockford also had a bike share program for about a year. And now the city of Chicago has launched its own pilot program of e-scooters this month. In parts of the West Side, there were about 11,000 rides in the first weekend alone. These options, especially scooters, have gotten some strong reactions. In the case of Chicago, you don't need to look much farther than the two dueling Twitter accounts. One is called Chicago Scooter Fails. Another is called Chicago Scooters Are Fine. We wanted to talk more about how shared scooters and bikes fit into our transportation system, if they do at all. For more on this, I'm joined by Kate Lowe, an assistant professor at UIC's Department of Urban Planning and Policy. Andrew Small is also with us. He's a freelance reporter and author of the City Lab daily newsletter. He's joining us from Washington. Kate, Andrew, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure.
Kate, I wonder if we can start with this pilot program in Chicago. How many scooters are we talking about in particular in Chicago that are going to be available?
So there are 10 vendors, and each is authorized to have up to 250 scooters out. So right now there's 2,500 scooters on the streets of Chicago. The pilot program launched on June 15th, and as you've mentioned, it's caused some strong reactions.
Andrew, I wonder if we could talk about the strong reactions. I was actually in Chicago over the weekend, and I was on the 606, which is this Bloomingdale Trail. It's sort of, for if you haven't heard of it, Andrew, it's kind of like the Chicago version of the High Line. It's an elevated trail, and it's already pretty crowded with walkers and runners and people on bicycles, and there were scooters there. And I saw notes afterwards saying scooters are not supposed to be allowed here, but they were also on there. Why do you think people have such strong reactions to the scooters, Andrew?
I mean, I think it's because they're such a new thing on streets that have had rules that have been established for, you know, anywhere between 150, you know, 100 years and 50 years, right? That some of the regulations that we've had in place for what kinds of vehicles go where or what modes of transportation go where haven't had, you know, the same kind of attention. You know, if you're a biker, you oftentimes are making the same decision about whether you're going to be on the road with cars where you feel kind of like your life is in danger, or if you're going to be on the sidewalk where you feel safe, but you might be, you know, encountering a little bit more friction with people who consider other, you know, vehicles that are moving fast to be kind of unsafe too.
And the safety of this is a concern. I mean, when we think about, are people wearing helmets? What are we knowing in it? What are we hearing anecdotally about how safe these scooters are?
I mean, the models have kind of updated over the last year. They went, there was the same kind of Xiaomi and Segway models that they had kind of beta tested to see how these different scooters perform with different markets and whether people would like them. The scooters, I mean, I think it still kind of comes back to how safe your roads are. You know, people tend to not want to wear helmets when they ride, you know, a bike share bike or a scooter. But, you know, I mean, in a lot of cases, a collision, especially if you're on the road with a vehicle, you know, a helmet only does you so much good when you come into contact with a car. Just yesterday in New York City, there was an activist who was actually killed. Their name was Robin Heitman, and they were 20-year-old. You know, they were riding on Sixth Avenue on a bicycle wearing a helmet. And I think that just speaks to, you know, when people feel like they want to get around quickly in dense cities like Chicago, like New York, we're running into how are we making decisions about how our roads are allocated for how people want to get around.
Kate, I mean, when we're thinking about the safety of this aside, I wonder if you can explain a little bit more about what particular transit problem local governments are trying to solve here, why we've seen so many local governments that are willing to try these out, whether they're scooters or, as we're talking about, the bikes, all of these different share programs.
Well, that's one of my hesitancies with the scooter problem, is I'm not sure what priority transportation problem they are best suited to solve. Certainly, they could be a small part of shifting the conversation into making streets safer for all users. They may entice a few commuters out of their cars and on to transit and use scooters as part of the journey. But what we found in initial research, well, I'm sorry, not to say we, others found in initial research, is that most commonly in Denver and Portland, scooters were replacing walking trips. So for some, walking is not a good option, so scooters provide an important mobility enhancement. But for many, it's just adding redundancy to a system and not improving environmental conditions. I did want to add on to the safety conversation that
Kate, can I stop you for a second? Can I ask you to hold that thought? Because we have to take a break. So sorry to interrupt you. But if we can, we're just going to take a short break here just for a minute or two, and we'll pick up this conversation on the other side of this with Kate Lowe. And Kate, if you can hold that thought about safety, I know lots of folks probably have questions or comments about that as well. Kate's with UIC's Department of Urban Planning and Policy. Andrew Small, author of the City Lab Daily Newsletter. We're talking scooters, bicycles, and more. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 3/4 of Americans still commute by driving to work alone, but Americans have also taken millions of rides on shared dockless scooters and bikes. We're talking about this right now with Andrew Small with CityLab and Kate Lowe with UIC. Kate, just before the break, you wanted to add about the safety of these things, and I was hoping you could finish that thought, because safety always does tend to be a big part of the conversation when we're talking about whether it's bicycles or scooters or, you know, even pedestrians.
Well, we certainly need to think about safety in terms of the broader roadway infrastructure. We've invested a lot in making safety improvements for those in vehicles. And while those fatalities are going down, pedestrian fatalities are going up. And I wanted to give the initial information we have about scooter safety in Chicago. So Block Club reports there's been 10 ER visits so far in a short period of time, and the city will be collecting information on injuries. And unfortunately, there was a rather sad event yesterday. A bicyclist was hit by a scooter in a hit and run and had several facial bones broken. So it's hard to unparse how much of this is inherent to the mode of e-scooters and how much is due to undertraining and how much is due to roadway conditions that are not built for users other than automobiles. But nationally, we have initial reports from Austin that found 1/3 of their survey respondents in the ER that had scooter injuries were actually taking their first scooter trip. Mm. So there's some concerning patterns, but it's hard to really understand all the different factors and what this looks like when it scales up.
And it's also natural to think, I mean, if we think about the number of car accidents that happen every day, as more and more people are using transportation options, unfortunately, that also involves accidents as well. But Kate, I wanted to hone in on one thing you said about the construction. And I just wanted to ask you about maybe some of them. When we think about just sidewalk space, many cities have bikes where you don't have to park them at a permanent station. That's how it works here in Champaign-Urbana. But there, most of other places have these big docking stations. Chicago has them. What are some of the challenges with having shared options? Is it in terms of sidewalk space and construction and things like that?
Well, there are advantages and disadvantages to the dockless model. And we did have a dockless bicycle pilot on the south side last summer in Chicago. And dockless models allow more flexibility. A vehicle may be closer to your origin point, and you can leave it closer to your destination. But there's certainly no guarantee that a vehicle will be closer to you with the dockless model. Both docked and dockless have problems of providing enough vehicles in areas of moderate density, and we've seen inequities in the distribution of sites. And one of the biggest problems with the dockless model is users who don't park the vehicles correctly. This is a nuisance to many, and for those with mobility impairments, a serious problem. And the Chicago pilot has a couple of features that are designed to mitigate that. One is that users are supposed to send a photo of the properly parked dockless vehicle. Another is that the companies are required to remove improperly parked vehicles within 2 hours. And third, the city is requiring the firms to pick up and redistribute the vehicles every day. So that would catch.
Right. And you see those in Chicago. Andrew, when we're thinking about these companies and the scooters, we're seeing these companies that are just put aside the bike share programs. The scooter companies are really, we're seeing a lot of these pop up all over, right?
Yeah. I mean, over the country, I mean, there's been about last year in 2018, there were 84 million trips in the country total, and scooters alone doubled the number of shared vehicles there were in the United States. So it's interesting in that, like, this is, a much less organized and less centrally planned way of getting people these shared vehicles compared to the docked systems of bicycles, you know, that have been around for about 10 years now in the United States, starting in D.C. D.C.'s been interesting because of the fact that we have both systems running at the same time in the same spaces, compared to Lyft. Lyft operates the bike share system in D.C. as it does in Chicago, but they've been allowed to operate within the same territory in D.C. Because of, you know, the way their contract is written out. And so it's been interesting to see who gets access to riding scooters. Like, I see more people who ride scooters who I would have never seen on a bike share bike in D.C., even though the bike share system is pretty equitably distributed and pretty well, like, penetrated throughout the city. There's concerning things with that, too. I mean, you'll see people, you know, people doubled up on a scooter, right? Like, they're riding together as
couples.
Seems
like a bad idea. Or kids, right? Also, because there's an age limit, but I know you were writing about kids who were circumventing that and hopping on them, even though that doesn't work.
And I think there are questions that cities have been reluctant to address because of the liabilities that are associated with that. Kids couldn't book a bicycle that, like, you know, a kid is still allowed to ride a bicycle, but they can't ride a city bicycle, right? Like, There's gray areas of things. There's symptoms that kind of get highlighted by this that says, hey, maybe there's something we should do for kids in D.C. to be able to get around during the summer when it's really fun to play around in town, you know. Or like with the doubled up scooter thing, I think it's funny that Bird has come out with, like, a little e-bike that has a two-seater, right? It's a perfect example of, like, here was a problem where there were two people riding on a scooter and it was dangerous. And so maybe that just means that people want to ride it, you know, together on something.
Right. So that's how it looks in big cities. Andrew Small has been talking to us about Washington, Kate Lowe about Chicago, but I wanted to welcome Sydney Turner to the conversation to share a little bit more about what this looks like in DeKalb. She's at our partner station WNIJ there. She's the Metro Program Manager for Region 1 Planning Council, provides city planning for Ogle, for Boone, for Winnebago counties. Hi, Sydney. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Sydney, how would you describe transit in Rockford for folks who don't live there and aren't familiar with what is available for people?
Sure. We follow a lot of what the national trends are, where a majority of our residents and workers actually use a personal vehicle to get around for their day-to-day businesses. However, you know, we're starting to look at what are some of these alternative transportation options for the people within our region, because not everyone has access to a personal vehicle. And so we do have a pretty extensive public transit system through RMTD that we utilize. And then last year, you know, we saw an increase with all the interest in the bike share programs on our bicycle facilities and really increasing that. So we've seen this kind of transformation in our area of the conversation starting of what are some additional options that people have to move around the city.
And so last year you did partner with one of these companies, Lime, for about a year for a dockless bike share program, Sydney?
Yes, that is correct. So it really started with a bike share feasibility study back when dockless bike shares weren't really a major emerging trend yet. And then as that started to kind of form, our agency reached out to multiple companies just to get more information on what dockless bike share is. And through that research, reaching out to some of these companies, Lime Bike decided that they were interested and wanted to come out and give us a presentation on kind of what their business model looked like and what bike share could do for the city of Rockford and the other municipalities in the region.
How did it go?
It was, I think, a great experience. There were several benefits that we found, and it was really kind of a launching point of people starting to talk about what are some of the bicycle safety? Because as you're increasing, you know, adding 200 bikes to a downtown area or busy commercial corridors, you know, what does that look like? And so it increased the awareness of safety around bicycles, you know, rules of the road for both bicyclists and pedestrians, personal vehicles, and sharing the roadway. And so that was really one of the benefits that we've seen. And some of it, too, is, you know, these companies' willingness to share data with us, with the local governments, to be able to start tracking where some of the people are utilizing the bike shares the most. That way, as a region, we can start planning where we need additional infrastructure to increase safety and really, you know, improve this overall transportation system.
We're talking with City Planner Sydney Turner. She's with Region 1 Planning Council for Ogle, for Boone, for Winnebago counties. And Sydney, so Lyme actually pulled out of Rockford earlier this year. Can you tell us why they decided to do that?
Our understanding is it's not unique to just the Rockford area. It happened in several areas with the company. They decided to move in a different direction, more towards the e-scooters, and kind of, you know, as a part of that, you know, out of our region as well.
So, Andrew, are we seeing that in other places, that places that Lyme had been doing dockless bikes or whether bike shares, whether they're docked or not, they pulled out because now they want to focus on scooters?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely been the case with the dockless companies in D.C. I mean, they've had a docked system to compete with, so it's a little bit different. But there's a lot of cities that have had that. I remember Newark was one that came to mind where when one of the companies folded last year, it completely disappeared from Newark, New Jersey. I think that's a pretty common experience in a lot of places because they're trying to find markets that are profitable for them. I guess the question, you know, for city planners to consider is that this is an easy way to do this quickly and convince people that it's a good idea. But it may not necessarily be a thing that becomes a way to get to, you know, a reliable form of transportation for work without the city putting some muscle behind making it into either a dock system or something that has some sort of semblance of order that people can expect and rely on it as a form of kind of the more grown-up transportation that, like, a docked system lends itself. I know every day, you know, at that dock that there's going to be that bike that has been brought up the hill by somebody who is, you know, taking concerted effort to make it so that it runs. Sometimes a lot of the dockless systems can be a little bit more ambling and going, you know, it's kind of a thing that tourists like to do in D.C., right? Like, it's a thing that's not meant to be a reliable way to get to work.
We're almost out of time here, but I just wanted to ask you, Andrew, maybe let's just end with you and ask you about, I was reading something you wrote about the fact that this is really, whether we're talking about scooters or bike shares, it's really not really talking about the problem of sidewalks and public space and if we're planning for that properly. Do you feel like we're missing that as part of the conversation here?
I think we are. It's hard because infrastructure takes so long to fix and to build, right? So there's a certain point where the emphasis on scooters, you know, you can talk about, I mean, people would like to have protected bike lanes. People would like to have, you know, parking maybe taken away from cars and turned into parking for scooters so that they're not on the sidewalks. And I think there's just a level of urgency given that so many people are deciding to use this as a way to get around. There's an urgency for cities to do something to make it so that they can accommodate it. So that people can feel like they can do it safely without having to have, you know, a degree in everything about dockless bike sharing or dockless scooters.
Right. Sydney, do you feel like this has changed the way that you guys are thinking about this in Rockford in terms of wanting to do something more in the future?
I think so. I think really the regional focus is going to be improving that infrastructure. And even if it's, you know, smaller, not major, complete reconstruction of roadways to accommodate them, you know, looking at what we can do on the smaller scale to at least increase that safety and provide those protections to both pedestrians, bicyclists, and, you know, vehicles.
That's Sydney Turner. Thanks for being with us. Joining us from our partner station, WNIJ in DeKalb. She's a Metro Program Manager with Region 1 Planning Council. I want to thank Andrew Small for being with us as well, author of the City Lab Daily Newsletter. And we'll tweet out some of Andrew's stories on this for folks that are interested in reading more. Kate Lowe has also been with us. She's an assistant professor at UIC's Department of Urban Planning and Policy. All of you, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program tomorrow.
Rapinoe will strike! Rapinoe scores! 2 NUS!
thanks to Fox Sports. That's the exciting conclusion to yesterday's World Cup match between the U.S. and Spain. We are going to bring you a preview. The U.S. women are up against France in the quarterfinals on Friday. We're going to be giving you a preview of that match, talking a little bit more about the World Cup on tomorrow's program. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. We're also on Facebook. It's a good way to message us if you want to get in contact with us. But all those links, every other way to contact us, you can just go to our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan, Jasper Davidoff, our interns, technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.